Let's pay a short homage to the Buddha and the Triple Gem, and then I'll begin speaking after. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So what do you say after an introduction like that? There's, of course, many things are popping up in my mind as appropriate to follow up on.
Excuse me, Ajahn-Pasa?
Yeah.
Maybe it's not on. Do you see if the button's on? Is it pushing?
Blue box.
The blue button.
In the middle.
Blue.
Here.
There you go.
Okay. There we go. Okay. That'll keep people happy. So the there's several themes that popped up and in my mind that I think would be worth exploring, and of course, first of all, to express my appreciation to Gil for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to meet you all, see the place, and to be a part of this adventure of sort of the IRC, Insight Retreat Center. And I particularly appreciate the fact that Gil is wanting to establish this place as a place that is that functions on dana, and that to me is a very important example that is worthy of bringing into our culture, the opportunity to to give, to share, to be a part of a whole culture of generosity is something that I think really essential as a maturing of Buddhism coming to America. On a certain level, the amount of centers there are, or the number of people, or the number of PhD graduates in Buddhist studies get pumped out of universities, doesn't necessarily, to me, indicate a real taking on of the principles of the Buddha. Whereas I think a commitment to generosity and sharing and real fundamental kindness and virtue are, that's when it's really seeping into the cells and the bones. And that's to me is really important. And to be able to have places that that model that, and of course, monasteries model that to a degree, to a large degree. To be able to have a within the lay society, to be able to model that and to set those examples is to me extremely important and wonderful to see. Because I was trained in Thailand, I lived there for 23 years, so that was what I grew up with, I think one of the things that is important in the way we perceive our own practice is when we perceive that we're practicing in order to give to the practice rather than to get something from it, and that's a very different shift. And it's when that's when we really start growing, is when we recognize that I can be the different and taking the different opportunities to give to the practice, give to situations that support practice, give to however the teachings are manifest. And so that having a retreat center like this, which is really going to be an opportunity for people to give, to share, to support, and be a part of. So that, because this is where, that's really where community is built. When we give and come from that heart of generosity, there's a connection that grows as just very natural as human beings. It's and I'm sure there's going to be all sorts of challenges and glitches and various difficulties, because it is a new model. But I think having a commitment to that, and having this I assume is really a core group of family that has been a part of supporting this and having the opportunity to help each other bring this to the kind of Santa Cruz Mountains, to kind of the peninsula area, to Bay Area, to America. I mean, it's these are things that you can all be sharing and giving, and recognizing that one is giving to something that is actually not personal. I think that's one of the things that is important. That when we can, what comes to mind is after the Buddha was enlightened, the Buddha was reflecting on his own kind of on a certain level a dilemma. Here he is, fully enlightened being, and he'd been looking for enlightened teachers, he'd been looking for enlightened friends, he'd been looking for other awakened beings, and he hadn't really found them. And then after his commitment to practice and training and his wisdom and effort came to fruition in his own awakening and liberation, is thinking, who do I, it's natural for us as human beings to want to pay respects, to give respect to others. Now, who do I respect? And when I look around, I don't see anybody else who's awakened. And then he continues his reflection and says, what is worthy of my always worthy of my respect is the Dhamma, this truth, these teachings, this a reality of existence. And so that was, and so that he always held Dhamma as the as what was always foremost in his mind. So what accorded with truth, what accorded with reality, this is what the Buddha always referred back to. And of course that's a wonderful example for all of us who are looking for what is it that accords with Dhamma, what is it that accords with truth, and to be able to be respectful, to be deferential, to hold that dear, and to look for the ways that we can accord with that truth, so that we align with it. So our practice ends up being not just a meditation technique or a retreat that we do from time to time, but it's all of our actions of body, speech, and mind that we bring into our daily life. And of course that's what comes into our practice. When we're able to really hold that clearly, when we come to sit and meditate, it's actually not that complicated. I was talking to the monks the other day, and I was saying how frustrating it was sometimes being with Ajahn Chah and asking for meditation instruction, and Ajahn Chah sort of said, you know, because when he would give meditation instruction, it would be sort of like, well, you know, you sit down cross-legged and then you keep your posture erect and alert, and then and you pay attention to the in-breath and the out-breath, and then you do that again, and then, you know, and then your mind gets peaceful. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and like, you know, what's the big deal? But it's... So it's because it's, I think, again, it's sort of using the, because we tend to think, I'm not getting quite the right technique, or I haven't quite got the right method, so I need another method to augment my spiritual practice so I can get my mind peaceful. But if we come back a few steps, and come those foundations of respect, of reverence, having that fundamental right view of what is it that's really true, what is it that's worthy of our attention, what is it that is actually truly beneficial and worthwhile, and that's a... So that when one sits meditation, yeah, it's not very complicated. There's a lot of joy and light that comes from that. So coming back to fundamental principles, and particularly those themes of generosity and virtue, goodness. These are fundamentals that really nurture the heart, and being able to both, you know, it's a practice, it's training that we keep plugging that in, but then it's also, you know, as manifest here, learning how to take the opportunity to give so that it's a benefit to others, and that's a source of great clarity, really, because the mind becomes very there's a joy that's there, and those are a tendency for us And it really is us of the I think all just in the human condition and us as meditators sort of the and certainly myself as beginning practice of really thinking, you know, when I get my meditation together, I'm going to be happy. And it's you know, it's that's a valid hope, but the Buddha doesn't actually teach that way, because what he teaches is that get your happiness together and your meditation sorted out. And it's really it's very interesting. It's stock phrases in the suttas. Many, many discourses where he begins with, and these are sort of the, again, setting out the different conditions, the conditioned nature of the mind. And he begins from different places, like the virtue or wise reflection or even sometimes from dukkha, from suffering. But it's... through faith, confidence. But then it goes into different starting points, but then it goes into stock phrases that of with these different conditions, there's the arising of well-being and pamoja. And with the arising of well-being, then there's what comes to be is a quality of joy. With joy as a condition, there's the arising of tranquility. With tranquility as a condition, there's the arising of happiness. With happiness as a condition, there's the arising of samadhi, or of steady stability of mind, concentration, meditative stillness. And some of the discourses, the Buddha actually stops there, and he actually explicitly sort of says, the happy mind is easily concentrated, and it's so that sense of you know, attending to the things that nurture those qualities of well-being, and we're, you know, we're thinking of the aspects of respect and reverence. The Buddha, there's a discourse where the Buddha points to five things which are, say, worthy of reverence, of course. And one is, of course, one is the, say, the teacher, the Tathagata, the Buddha himself, and the Dhamma, the teachings. Sangha, the community that has passed, held the teachings. And then the next one is the training. Sort of in the sense of, you know, one has that kind of respect and reverence to the recognition that what the Buddha has given us is a training. You know, so many religions, philosophies, you know, have, and intelligent people can really talk about high ideals and how the world should be and how you should be. But the Buddha doesn't really approach it from that way. Here's a training. This is take the human condition and work within it, train within it, develop the skills of being a wise human being, you know, there'll be fruits. So that sense of that respect for training. And then the last thing that the Buddha says is worthy of respect and reverence is the qualities of um, Hospitality is maybe a way to translate it. And sort of like looking after others. So again, the sense of this is a place that's being created, that you can take those principles and bring that sense of implementing that respect, and then giving other people the opportunity to come into contact with something that where there is this respect for the Buddha, for say an example of an awakened being in the world, that the Dhamma, the teachings, the Sangha, the training itself, and that sense of welcoming and being one who is, because that's where that generosity comes in, is that sense of honoring and welcoming, creating a space that where people feel welcomed and looked after. So that these aspects of our of our practice, these are things that again, it's helpful to keep things practical. It's like we're down having tea with Gil before coming up here, so Gil, what you really need is a maintenance manual. You need a database and a maintenance manual. I mean, the Buddha has a similar kind of approach where there are these opportunities we have for peace and tranquility and meditation, but we'd also have to learn to look after things in a practical way, and particularly when it's it's like a meditation center, there'll be many people that will be here, and just everybody learning how to take it on or perceive it as our retreat center. It's not Gil's retreat center. Sort of like our retreat center, so that people are willing to help out and take responsibility. I gave a reflection to the monks this morning on in the early morning after our breakfast. I give a short reflection, and one of the other senior monks or somebody will give a short reflection on how to take things into daily life, and how to apply the teachings in our ongoing practice of living together in the monastery. And I used the theme of a cartoon that the assistant abbot Ajahn Yatiko just got from his mother. And the cartoon is of a, it's like in a Christian setting, environment, and there's a senior monk in the front, and then sort of a kind of a row of other monks in front of him, and the caption is most of you some of you newcomers will know our philosophy here. Monk he see, monkey do. They may not have, it was done as a play on words, they may not have actually seen the implications of it. That sense of, you see something that needs to be done, and you do it. And you see something that should be rectified, should be fixed, and you do it. And that's taking responsibility and taking it on and everybody helping. And sort of that sense of it. When we all live in a place and we perceive it as ours, and that's what community is in Sangha, where we really take responsibility for each other and for the place. So that's important. And there's a phrase that Ajahn Amaro used to use from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That was when something wasn't being done, or something was being left, or something was being assumed but being neglected. It gathers an SEP field around it. Which an SEP field is somebody else's problem. in a place like this, in a retreat center, and just keeping their eyes open, making sure that SEP fields aren't sort of coming into being in different places. These are ways of reflecting and perceiving the actual place that we practice and train in, and it's a training. And when one that's taken as a training, then you start seeing, I give to the training. It isn't sort of I get from the, because you do get from the training, but you get back what you put into it. So that sense of really paying attention to how one is giving to it. Because in the end, a lot of the practice, the tools that we rely on are the tools of renunciation. I think I'm assuming that everybody here is here on the first retreat and you've all been practicing for a long time, got a lot of experience in practice. But it's really, I think, important to be recognizing that our practice has to be grounded in a certain ethos, and so that both that ethos of giving, but then also giving up, of renunciation, if renunciation isn't palatable, that relinquishment, letting go, these are they have a similar, because sometimes we think, renunciation, I'm really losing something, I'm giving up something. But it's actually, what one relinquishes is that releasing of that which is a burden anyway. So it's an incredible relief when we recognize, I was really able to put that down. And the mind becomes even brighter. Ajahn Chah used to say that there was there's only two things you need to do in practice: know and let go. Just those two things, that establishing of awareness, establishing of clarity, and establishing of attention, so that there's a clear knowing, and then a letting go, a relinquishing, a willingness not to cling on to, whether it's externally in terms of the world or objects of our senses, or internally, our own opinions, views, moods, feelings, projections, whatever. It's not that we don't have them or that they're not there, but they're held in a place of knowing and letting go. So you don't have to actually push anything away. You don't need to try to get rid of anything. Because one, it isn't yours anyway. and it isn't stable either. So that was like one time, the very first time that Ajahn Chah went to England. This was his first trip to the West, and it was actually at a Tibetan retreat center, monastery as well. Right? There was a monastic presence, and somebody came to ask a question about practice, and they asked Ajahn Chah, I just have such a problem with anger and ill will, and how do I deal with it? How do I get rid of it? How do I let go of it? And Ajahn Chah says, oh, that's easy. So just next time you get angry, just get an alarm clock and set it for 2 hours and see if you can hold that mood for 2 hours. See if you can do that. Which was sort of just the total opposite of what the person was, thinking or assumed. Ajahn Chah would probably give some kind of, you just need to develop loving kindness or blah, 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 blah. And it's just pointing really directly at the impermanent, unstable, uncertain nature of whatever we experience, and even the moods that you think define yourself, they're not stable. They're there because we keep identifying with them, but that doesn't make them stable. It just means we identify with them. So it's seeing clearly. Oh wow, that's its nature. And of course, that's you start seeing things in accordance with Dhamma, and that's really the function of our practice. So that as we continue to brand, how many days is this retreat for? 3 nights. Okay. So that you've got these 3 nights, to take the time to be practicing and cultivating, but pay attention to the meditation, pay attention to the technique, pay attention to the effort and energy that you put into it, but pay attention to how you hold the practice itself. There's a very beautiful, very short discourse in the Sanyutta Nikaya, at the beginning with the there's a lot of poems and verses, and a lot of them are quite short, and this one is in the Deva Samyutta, so it's sort of the discourses and conversations that the Buddha had with devas. And anyway, there's many of them are poems that are, or verses that are presented to the Buddha as a expression of that being's understanding or that person's understanding. And then the Buddha will either approve of it and, or he'll kind of try to correct that so that it's more beneficial. And then this one particular discourse is one where the it's sort of as what is that? As if smitten by a sword, as if one's head were on fire, the monk should wander mindfully for the relinquishing of sensual desire. Would you think that's pretty good? You know, that effort and that focus on sensual desire, which points to as a basis of suffering. But the Buddha immediately takes it and basically repeats it, phrase as if smitten by a sword, as if one's head were on fire, the monk should wander mindfully for the overcoming of identity view. So it's that identity is the desire, yeah, I mean it's there, but what feeds it is the identification. And all the other manifestations of the kind of the stains of the mind are not so much they're obviously have their painful result and complication and whatnot, but what really feeds it is that identification and the identity. This is mine. This is who I am. This is myself. That's the fundamental misapprehension of truth, of kind of the way things are. We say when we take Dhamma as refuge, then it's not just in abstract teachings. It's in the kind of fundamental view of how the world works, how us as human beings work, and to be able to keep returning to that investigation of where is that, where are those seeds of identification. And of course, this is where the Buddha, I mean, there's many different ways that the Buddha points to, but one of the most frequent is the say the five khandhas, five aggregates of being: form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, and the different ways that we create that sense of identity. This is who I am. I'm my body, or I have a painful feeling, and it's just I'm oppressed by this painful feeling. Or I'm able to experience this happiness and well-being. And so this is who I really am. But it's that kind of slipping into the identification that is the problem, because it sets oneself up for separation from what one has perceived as reality, and then this bumping up to things not being the way one wants them to be, so that sense of investigation of what we identify with, how we do it, and there's a a discourse where the Buddha points to there's a certain principle that the Buddha talks about in many places which is in the scriptural language, is that dhamma nu dhamma patibhata, practicing dhamma in accordance with dhamma. So that that in itself is a kind of a mouthful to reflect on, but it's actually one of the conditions that the Buddha points to as a condition for the arising of stream entry. So that there actually the Buddha points to two external conditions, two internal conditions. One is the drawing close to association with good beings, with good spiritual beings, and then hearing the true Dhamma, hearing good teachings, and then so that those are external conditions. Internal conditions are wise reflection, skillful attention, and then the last one of practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. And because you reflect on it, there's so many ways that, you know, Dhamma can be, you know, we can practice Dhamma with confusion, we can practice Dhamma with greed, we can practice Dhamma out of compulsion, we can practice Dhamma out of feeling of duty, and you know, all these different ways that we can do it. But that practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, when the Buddha defines it, he said it's just taking these five aggregates of being and reflecting, investigating, contemplating these five aggregates of being, and so that we practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma is say manifested or implemented by, you know, this contemplation of form, the body, physical form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. And so when one contemplates those aggregates of being over and over, more and more clearly, one understands them. And one understands these five aggregates of being. And when one understands form, feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness, one is released from them. And so it's this willingness to sort of being, and when one is released from them, one is released from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, all of the things where we really want, we should be willing to be done with. So that sense, oh yeah, these are fundamentals of the practice. And so bringing it back to that fundamental, you know, just knowing and letting go, knowing and letting go. And it's that knowing of these it isn't sort of the kind of astute accumulation of yeah, more philosophical debate, or but it's coming back and investigating our own experience. And we've so that we have all of the basis of our successful and fruitful practice right here with this body, this mind. It's not far away. It's not, and it's not anywhere else. So we can be using these circumstances, both in terms of retreat, formal meditation, but that same contemplation, you know, learning how to carry that into our interactions, our taking on of responsibility, of being a human being. One of the teachers in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa, one of the ways that he would say that, say from the scriptural language, the word that is used as the human being is someone with a kind of a developed heart, and that's a you know, that's what is what defines us as human beings. And one is the that we are capable of developing our hearts and developing our wholesome qualities, and that we take that opportunity and use it. So that having taken human birth and then had the opportunity to come into contact with the Buddhist teachings and come into contact with situations that are able to support us in our practice, then to put forth the effort, and then also be able to share it with others. So I think I'll leave it there for today.
Honoring us with this wonderful talk, and as we begin our centuries-long caretaking of the Dharma here.
Yes, I mean, that's the thing, is this is, we have no idea where this is going. and it's great, you know, these are such early days you think of, you know, the taking of Buddhism into China, and took several hundred years to really, before it really kind of took hold and started to gain momentum. And actually, even now, one of the things Reverend Hung Shur told me is that in China, Buddhism is still registered as a foreign religion. So it's places like Tibet, Japan. I mean, these have, it's always you look at the history, and it's always gone in waves, and it takes time to really put down roots, and say like in Thailand, there's no real clear understanding of when Buddhism really came and how it was established. They don't have a sense of a historical sense. So that a lot of it goes sort of into mythology, and it's only really clear around the 12th or 13th century that there's starting to be real written chronicles. Here in America, it's still very early days.
It might be useful for us to remember that we're kind of novices, that we weren't not going to figure it out in our generation.
Yeah.
In our lifetime,
yeah.
We're laying the groundwork so it can...
Yeah, and that's why my... you know, things that I was speaking about, really trying to get people to reflect that, what the foundations are, and recognizing that the foundations that you lay for other people will be, they can continue to build on that, and those principles, when they're laid down, they're not really they don't get worn out. It's like Ajahn Chah used to say that one of the images that he used of you know, practicing so that our practice is grounded in Dhamma. He said it's like, you know, you really want to be encouraging yourself to really ground it in true Dhamma, you know, practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. He said, because it's like If you've got, because we all exist on water, we need to have drinking water, so that one of the things that is commonly used in Thailand for drinking water is to have these big earthen jars and collect rainwater, which you then use through the year, which is great. Rainwater is very pure. But if there's a long dry season, you run out. Or it gets broken somehow, and you run out of water. Instead, you need to be able to really put the effort in to dig a well where the water is right down into the water, where it's right down in the water table, and that the water is always there for you. He said, that's when we practice Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, it's like having a well that's always, the water is always there for you. It's right down to the roots. Do you want to open it up for questions, or?
Yes, that would be nice.
Yeah. I'm happy to come all this way. I'm happy to ask or answer questions if anybody wants.
Bhante, would you give an example of practicing Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma, sort of a everyday example that we could know what you mean by that?
A lot of things that they even said in terms of not letting SEP fields gather around things. Somebody will do it. whereas seeing something and saying, oh, that needs to be done. I'll do it. It comes from, there's a certain clarity, a willingness to sort of give up one's own kind of, because everybody wants to be comfortable, not have to do much.
Right.
So that in itself, coming back this is rooted in Dhamma. Or the choices that we make in terms of virtuous conduct and precepts. It isn't sort of a moral principle that I've got to hold because there's some Buddha or Bodhisattva holding the club of the precepts over you. It's sort of like, this is how to act with integrity. This is how to act with a care for others. That's like one of the things that the ways that the Buddha talked about precepts as being the five great gifts, so that the gift of the five precepts being action that is a giving of security, a giving of safety, a giving of trust. And that's in accordance with Dhamma. So rather than, we're keeping precepts because we feel guilty if we don't, or fearful for some reason or other, or any number of reasons, but that it's that rooted in recognizing that this is conduct that's in accordance with Dhamma, and in accordance with truth, and then it becomes this wonderful gift, because the degree of trust and dynamics of human interactions change. There's a really great example of that with Master Shu Yun, who was a very revered Chinese monk from last century into the middle. He lived to be 120. Many incredible stories about him. One of the things that he did, a lot of pilgrimages, of these three steps and one bow across China. And then he did a lot of traveling sometimes to establish monasteries or teach meditation retreats. There's a transcript of a meditation retreat that he gave when he was 114 or 116 or something. On one of these occasions when he was traveling, he was on a bus, and it was in the period of the conflict between the nationalists and the communists, and a lot of instability in the country. And there was a group of bandits stopped the bus and got on board, and they had weapons and they were taking valuables from everybody. Master Su Yun was sitting, they came up to him and they sort of saw he was a monk and an old monk, and he said, Reverend, Venerable, we're sorry, we don't want to kind of inconvenience you, it's not great conduct, but that's what we're about these days. We respect you and don't want to harm you, so we'll just leave you as you are. Master Su Yun just sort of looked at them very, kind of kindly, and said, if you really believe that, you would give all of that back to these people. And that was it. And then that would just totally confuse them and befuddle them. And then they just started giving it all back. And then got off the bus. And I'm sure there was a, what the heck happened there? But it's sort of like that contact with somebody who really holds virtue. It has a different feeling. So it's a gift. Incredible gift.
So part of what I hear you saying is that practicing Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma isn't some deeply esoteric thing that will confuse us and like we have to...
I hope not.
No. So it could be something as direct as following integrity.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. Because I think there's certain equations that we follow, no pain, no gain. I'll be happy when I get my meditation together. The more complicated I can think about this, the more profound it must be. Those are all they're good. They're assumptions to be reflected on.
Thank you.
Okay. Hey, you got one. Okay. Oh, yeah.
And then gradually progress.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, that's the nature of the Buddha's path, that there are these loops going around. And that was that was actually Ajahn Chah's first trip to the West, went to England, and rather than stoplights, they got all these traffic circles, and he said, "Oh, this is just like Dhamma. It's like the Eightfold Path, and it's all these, you know, it's always these loops going around." You know, and that really is. It's always feeding back, and if you think it's point A to point B like this, and that's when it gets a bit complicated. When you realize, so it's like learning how to plug into the things that keep those feedback loops going, feeding, giving nutriment to. Well, the thing is you don't actually have to know, in the sense of, if you're looking for the absolute beginning and then really defining the end really clearly. I mean, the end has a certain feeling, but that sense of, if you pick up the path at any point, it leads you in and you just keep developing it. It's just like, picking up, there's a corner here, and it's just, only a little bit, but if I start pulling on it, the whole thing's going to go. that's the same in our practice. Just starting in any place where it makes sense, then you start to realize how it connects together. Because that's the conditioned nature of the teachings and the path, the conditioned nature of truth. There's interwoven, interlocking aspects of these conditions. Okay, so I'll take leave of you all. And enjoy the rest of your retreat.